Welcome to Conversations with Consequences, now on EWTN Radio. I'm your hostess, Betsy Fentress, and I'm very happy to have Sister Danielle Victoria, part of the Sisters of the Little Way, joining me today. She is also co-hosting a podcast with her fellow sister, Teresa Alethea, called Descent into Light. And we are just now going into November, the month where we remember the holy souls and the dead. And another project that these two sisters were involved in was a book on Memento Mori. So we have lots to talk about today, sister. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So a little background on you. You're from Battle Creek, Michigan, home of Kellogg cereal, and you are the seventh of nine children. You have 45 nieces and nephews, but there's a really interesting story that you went to an unlikely place to form people for the religious life, which is the Rhode Island School of Design, where you studied photography and film. So, and you are now working on a master's in spiritual direction with a special focus on helping those who have experienced spiritual abuse. We're going to talk about that, sister, but let's talk a little bit about how you got from Rhode Island School of Design, otherwise known as RISD, to where you are today.
Yeah, thank you so much. You know, whenever you ask a Michigander where they're from, they'll show you either the upper or lower peninsula. And I'm from Battle Creek, is right down here in the palm. Might even have it flipped.
Great.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm from a big Catholic family and was raised in the faith. My family was really active in the early charismatic renewal in Michigan. And when I went off to RISD, my mother, kind of like worst nightmare, really. She said, "You're going to lose your faith there, you know." And at that point, I just really wanted to pursue my passion. I had received a Fulbright scholarship to be able to study the arts. And I'm not entirely sure I would have went to college if it hadn't been for that opportunity in my life. And it itself kind of was a big change for the trajectory of my life. But while I was in school, really studying my passion, I enjoyed every single moment of it. But I also found this like really difficult to integrate my faith. I had like Swiss cheese size holes of kind of catechesis and a real lack of understanding of like Catholic social teaching and things to be able to integrate the truth kind of in a natural way, you know, through beauty and through my studies. But I like to say that while I was losing kind of my childhood faith, and there was sort of like this sort of deconstruction happening in my faith through kind of like full line and sinker, I was really invested in postmodernism and its theory in the arts, especially around photography, because that's very much a part of the discussion of the history of photography. Wow. So I was very fascinated by the theory. And so it really worked on my heart. It was more the ways in which different artists that I was attracted to, like the Dusseldorf school of, you know, of photography and thought. And like, there's like where you're deconstructing the frame of photography. Like, what is this hole punch in history and in memory? And unlike painting, you're pulling from reality. So you're also dealing with theory of reality. You're dealing with optics. So you're dealing with theory of light and dark and shadow, but also the science of it too. So there were so many things for me that spoke of time and eternity, and it was a dialogue. And so for me, photography and film was a conversation with the deepest things of my heart, but also meeting life and circumstance. And it gave me a chance to look at things, moments in time longer, and to sit with them. So there was something kind of infinite or internal about the snap of a photograph. And kind of while I was in school, one thing that I tried to do, I carried around a Land camera, which is a 4x5 inch negative where, you know, and you have to like, I had it on a dolly and I would roll around. I took it into Europe and went traveling with it to use it like a 35 millimeter camera because I wanted to capture these sudden moments, though it was this big, huge machinery to try to capture it with. I wanted to capture them in a precious way. And I think that kind of tenderness, that kind of care around the human experience, that these kind of happenstance moments are captured in a flicker, but done with such care, they spoke to me of vulnerability and the sacredness of capturing something very human. And the artists that I was interested in were very human people. And
can you name some of them?
You know, one artist we spoke about, Emmett Gowan, was very important to me. You know, yeah, it's so like off the top of my head. So in so many directions, Dorothea Lange was very important to me.
wonderful female photographer that did a lot of work for the WPA documenting migrant
Yes.
people in Oklahoma.
And what really attracted me to her work was that this idea they capture these very sacred human moments that amidst the chaos and amidst history, but they were like a painting. They were like a still life almost,
Yeah, and she has
of
that
history,
really,
a whole bunch of time.
I'm sorry, she has that really famous picture that
Yeah.
most people would recognize of her with her children, and she's got a very wizened face, and there's so much dignity at the same time to that. It's probably the most famous depression photograph out there.
So in that way, I did also always think about photography as I would now describe as like a spiritual direction, because it was the deepest stuff of my heart. And there's a consequence on the canvas or on the frame of whatever thing you produce. There's a part of you that speaks back to you. And either you're willing to listen or not. And I mean, like, it's a part of you that you may not even be conscious of, like the good, the bad, the ugly, the beautiful. And it's whether or not you're willing or have the courage to look at it with real sincerity.
That's really
So
interesting.
that room, that space where we had critique.
Whenever
Go ahead,
somebody
sorry.
talks about reality in this subject, I always want to say, well, there is something called the real presence, and when you find it, you will really understand what reality is. And did that happen to you? Was there some kind of longing for the Eucharist or the sacraments? You said you fell away from the church.
I was kind of moving away from the church with the lack of integration in my personal life, but in like my studies and in my heart and in my theory, I was longing for the Eucharist and specifically the Eucharist. I was attending a mass that was in a little side chapel with a Sudanese community. And I think it was just being able to be in a place that was familiar, but also culturally very different than what I had been brought up in that really attracted me to kind of continuing to go to mass and to be in that community. And I started to wonder, like, what really happens when someone receives the Eucharist? What really is happening there? And can it be captured? So I had this project that I ended up just writing a proposal for, but not actually executing. But it was to photograph people before they receive the Blessed Sacrament and after. And this is really someone who's like on their way out of the church, someone who's, I had never been to Eucharistic adoration. I just was really enamored with this question. And I was like, well, I pursue questions in my art. I should pursue this question in my art. And in the end, I discerned that, like, well, I don't know. I feel like that's a really sacred moment. And I don't want to like ask these people to do this. So I decided not to do it. But I was very curious. And I even wrote a grant to photograph ways in which the Blessed Sacrament is held in all different parts of the world. So like in places where, people are not able to publicly worship God or have the Blessed Sacrament reposed in a tabernacle, like how do people receive the Blessed Sacrament? Like this idea of the profane and the sublime and the sacred, and then like where is God in this and is it real? So I was curious, but yeah, but God had other plans because before I was able, I didn't get that scholarship to go do that. Then a week later, I had a conversion experience where God just, in a moment, literally pierced my heart. And it was a moment of utter clarity that dramatically changed my life. And I kind of call it my holy two by four because I think that I could have been caught in that world of theory and just stirring around in all of those things forever. I mean, I just could have been entertained by that, I think, and traveling the world and doing documentary work. I felt like I would even be single doing that work. I felt such a call on my life to ask these questions and pursue these things. But I had a clarity that who I thought God was, I was wrong about. And who God was someone who had a plan for me. And that was all I knew. And that was both very devastating and freeing at the same time. And I don't really have a better way to describe it, but it was like in a whole postmodern kind of idea of things, you can decontextualize anything and create your own thing of everything. So it's like this complete reconstruction of your life and relativism, right? So that's exhausting. It's exhausting to have to
Absolutely.
understand everybody's reality in order to understand your own and how your two realities meet in all these different places. And it's unique every time. And, there's no universals. And I felt this weight lift and just fall to the floor, a breath gone. And then I was like, my 10-year plan, like I just graduated with a degree in photography and film, like it, and I want to be a fine art artist. Like, what am I going to do? Even though I had received a scholarship, tuition had doubled. I had student debt even on top of that because it's expensive. But I knew that I just wanted to move home and be close to my family, that those prayers that kind of were, it was like backlogged prayer and grace that I wasn't able to receive, but that like all those rosaries my family was praying, and my grandmother used to badger me, was sending me little pamphlets on the from EWTN. She would mail them to me on the rosary, and she even like wrote Mother Angelica once saying she was praying for me, and she sent me the letter she received back
What did it say?
of a response.
Just that
Well,
Mother
it was
Angelica would
kind of like
pray
a
for you?
formal letter. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so like I really think of it as like my grandmother's holy badgering. It really saved my life in a lot of ways, you know, brought me back into a deep and profound understanding of our Lord and my relationship. But it also, I think, made me open to my vocation. From there, I really just I felt that deeper call to religious life. And some of that journey I do share in our podcast because it's kind of intertwined even in that discernment that I made.
The 30-day retreat. That's a
The
really,
30, yes.
that's a hard podcast to listen to because it didn't go the way that you thought it would, and there was a lot of pain in there.
There was. And it, you know, there was a lot of things I had to unpack with the spiritual director who was leading me through that 30-day retreat. Later, we found out many years after that he actually sexually assaulted a sister, allegedly. And, you know, that was devastating, a devastating revelation, you know, later. But also, God sowed incredible seeds, and he did introduce me to the community that I would later join. And I do believe that, you know, though my journey, you know, has been one wrapped in mystery, that God was a part of that, that in the light and the shadow of those things, it makes a fuller picture. And God sowed that seed of my vocation amidst those things for a reason. And I followed Jesus into this call within a call to really reach a different group of people that, you know, as we were evangelizing in our mission, we came across again and again how these wounds caused by members of the church, especially those who are in the positions of leadership, who are really in a position of authority, how they undermine the authoritative voice of the church. And so often we may want to preach the gospel, but we're not addressing the deeper wounds that really make it impossible to have our words matter, or they fall short or flat for people. So this call was kind of coming up, and I could see as I was discerning and it was becoming more clear, I could see that this call had been there from the beginning, that it had been becoming more and more clear as time was coming along.
So, as a result of this painful experience where you're trying to discern whether to become a religious sister or not, you have a spiritual director who is sort of taking advantage of their position with you. And that eventually leads to this podcast that you now do. The name of the podcast is called Descent into Light. But what are you trying to do in this podcast that you just have started in like the last 6 weeks?
Sure. So for the last 2 years, Sister Teresa Lathey and I have been working on composing this podcast. It's 8 episodes long, and it follows the process of grief. We're looking at spiritual abuse and sexual abuse in spiritual settings. And the reason for this, of first of all, following the setting of grief or the stages of grief, is because when you're confronted with something that goes so deep to the core of the most important decisions a person makes. Like for me, discernment into religious life or my relationship with God, the only thing to do is to sit with the mystery of it all. And grief, and that process of grief, holds the tension of the things that were the dark and the light, the bad things that have happened and the good that God does despite all on the ill intentions of another. And that really was our process. That was our process of like coming to terms with, amidst all of this, I received my vocation. Amidst all of this, even the revelation of it all, I received a new call within a call. And so God was alive and working through it. So we interviewed different experts, theologians, philosophers, different Catholic thinkers, sociologists, and psychologists. And we also spent last year, we were in Rome, and we were invited by Father Hans Sohlner at the IADC, which is the Institute of Anthropology, Dignity, and Care at the Gregorian in Rome, to study safeguarding. And that was really the first opportunity we had to really delve into this topic in an international way, which changed the way we approach the work that we do radically to see, how these things are being impacted across the globe. So that we brought that back in our stories and how we share our stories. But the succession of the episodes really starts very intimately in our own stories, but as it goes through, it widens. And we're inviting the audience. This isn't just about one person. Abuse unfolds within a context, and that's how we can really understand how to safeguard.
It must be disturbing for you to watch this ongoing issue with Father Rupnik, who was an artist and was accused of abusing several religious women. That must just really resonate with you and anger you that this is still somewhat unresolved as to his place in the church. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I'd say when we went to Rome and we were able to study kind of in the shadows of the Vatican, I would say that studying this topic was absolutely discouraging in so many ways. But it was also encouraging that you could understand why things happen the way that they do. This is a massive church. It's, throughout the whole world. And you can see how there's really a lack of understanding of accountability in so many areas, but there's also the opportunity for accountability. We didn't expect to come out of that experience hopeful, but God has been showing us how there, just as we can, as a universal church, these things can happen, the cover up, the patterns of abuse can happen repeatedly and across the globe. They can spread in kind of like a systematic way. So can the good. And so can our choices to be conscious and aware and alert of these signs and red flags and boundaries and power differentials that need to be respected and to better understand what true vulnerability means, like the sacredness of vulnerability, not vulnerability as a deficit. We have this opportunity, especially with the digital world, to spread a different kind of message within the church and to choose different things. And I think we're at a really unique moment to do that now that, maybe we've been lagging in response, but we can also jump ahead. And so there is a hope. There is a hope. And the Rupnik reality is extraordinarily discouraging, but the creativity that's coming out of those survivors to share their stories, the courage, the witness, even Sister Samuel, who is creating a project right now of her own mosaic, incorporating the stories of survivors into a mosaic that would sit opposite of Rupnik's own mosaics. I wrote an article on our Substack, sistersofthelittleway.com, about this, my own take while I was in Rome on Rupnik's art, because we were visiting a friend and we went into the chapel. And, I think that week we were studying the reality of abusers in our studies. And I get into the chapel and I go to bless myself. And it's a Rupnik chapel, floor to ceiling, mosaic.
Ay.
Rupnik Chapel. And I didn't ex you know I mean you gain a certain tolerance in this work, and but it caught me off guard. And so I write about that experience, but then I also write about reflecting on how his work is not just about bad art or something, and so it needs to be taken down, and he did bad things, so equals take it down. It was about desecration of the sacred, of the holy. And it's important, in my opinion, as an artist, that we don't just erase history, as a documentarian, by just removing his art and it just disappearing. But what I like about Sister Samuel's idea of having a mosaic opposite his work, I still think that these things don't belong in sacred spaces. They don't belong in places where we celebrate the liturgy. They're not liturgical items, artifacts anymore. But it does contextualize, it recontextualizes the work in its proper context of being artifacts of abuse. Because quite literally, these women were abused while creating, consecrated women were abused while creating the actual work itself that is used for worship. And
Unbelievable.
if this art is to raise our senses to the holy, it has been desecrated.
So maybe all your postmodernism theory is coming to your aid right now. When you said that to recontextualize, I thought, well, that's a fancy word there that makes us understand. I mean, sister, God put you in art school for a reason. I mean, this is a crazy path that you have followed, but it's really fascinating. And I think a lot of people have been upset about this, and I love the way you're talking about it. I want to switch for just a second because I think they're all fit together, because I think that abuse can make the church feel dead to people, and they'll feel dead in their soul about, what's happened to them. We're going into the month of Memento Mori, and that was also something that you were involved in illustrating, a prayer journal with Sister Teresa Alethea. How does reflecting on the four last things, death, judgment, heaven, hell, fit into all the things we're talking about?
Actually, Memento Mori is a big part of our life and the way that we even approach the work that we do. And we do an examen every day, thinking about our life in relationship to our death. Because if we are not willing to see what we are doing today in light of eternity, will I have the courage to make the choices that are necessary to stand alongside those who the most vulnerable? And not only that, I think that confronting our death makes us aware or sensitizes us, even in the slightest way, by reflecting in small ways of the little things that we avoid to die to in our daily lives, which, kind of help us escape our own vulnerability. I mean, what is greater or more vulnerable than the fact that you could die? Jesus came to us, his power and his glory swaddled naked in a feeding trough. He was very vulnerable. His vulnerability was very exposed to the elements. There's something so central and foundational to our faith and our life, and to even what he teaches us about through the cross. And through his crucifixion, with that, it started in a feeding trough. It started in vulnerability and it ended in vulnerability. So, naked on the cross, he was completely exposed. And for what? For us and nothing. And it was total. It was a total gift. So, that memento mori, which so we wear a cross on our apron, which is our scapular. And at the bottom, it's Jesus alive on the cross in this mystery of this moment where he's crying out to the Father in the mystery of his own feeling or experience of forsakenness. And below is a skull, which is, represents the skull of Adam and Jesus as the new Adam, that we need not be afraid to give totally of our life today, wherever that is, whatever small ways, whatever big ways, and big ways, it means creating an audio documentary that details sort of the most vulnerable moments of our lives in order to lend our stories so that other people might find the language or feel affirmed or seen or known in their own journeys, or that others can learn from an experience they might not have had, but be sensitized to that reality in the church. But it also means small ways that I recognize the vulnerability of another or the need of another or to do something that's uncomfortable, sort of Saint Therese's little way of her little way beads, of like, I pick up this piece of paper for you, Lord. Like, we die in big and small ways, but they are all eternally valuable.
One of the voices on one of your podcast episodes is Father Boniface Hicks, and it's very powerful to hear a priest talking about how grave what has happened is. And he seems to be very in tune with the harm, the deep harm this has caused in theological terms as much as everything else. How has he helped you, Sister Danielle, with your new apostolate?
Yeah, Father Boniface Hicks has been a great asset to us in his capacity to really see deeply into the need for our mission, and also God's work in our lives, because it can kind of be a mysterious thing. Like, what are we doing? I mean, we've asked ourselves that all along the way of like, can we even do this? And so Father Boniface has, first of all, he's the director of the program that I'm participating in and getting my master's in right now, the spiritual direction program at St. Vincent Seminary, the Institute for Ministry and Formation. And I really appreciate how he goes to great lengths to make sure his coursework integrates psychology psychology, and is very trauma-informed. And so it's been helpful to go through that program and kind of, even he's very receptive of, getting feedback of like what's helpful and what's not in that regard. So it's been beautiful to see his reception of this topic and therefore creating a space for people to be received in their own experiences.
So, sister, as we wrap up, what do you say to people who have been hurt by people in the church for going forward in hope and not letting it define who they are?
I think for anyone, who might be listening that has been harmed by the church, or also anyone who has a loved one who experiences this hurt. First, to those who have experienced this hurt, and I just want to say I'm sorry on behalf of the church. I'm sorry for what you experienced, and I'm sorry if in that experience you have not been received by others, because very commonly the thing that we hear recurringly is that sometimes when someone decides to come forward with their experience or share it with someone else, they are often not received, and that can be more wounding than the actual event itself. I'm so sorry for how that has happened for so many people. Also, I would encourage that what I have witnessed in survivors of all kinds, they teach us what kinds of abuses people suffer. There is an instinct, a trust in one's conscience, a need to trust those instincts that get overridden in the process. And I just think that there's a light and a truth that survivors or people who have experienced these things or people close to these situations hold and bear that the church desperately needs, that we need to listen to and to share and to know the value that they are to us. And oftentimes, the fringes of the church are fringes like in a fabric that get worked out from the center. I also think of like fringes, like the fringes of Jesus's garment, where the hemorrhaging woman came and was healed because she had the courage to touch. And I think for the church, those who are suffering outside of the church, those who feel exiled or cut off in some way or unable to enter or darken the doors of the church, I think they have something to say to us that's deeply valuable that we need to listen to.
Sister, this has been a real honor to talk about these hard subjects. Thank you so much for joining us. To learn more about your work, we invite our listeners to go to sistersofthelittleway.com. And to learn more about the Catholic Association, go to catholicassociation.org to follow everything we do in radio, TV, print, online, and in our local communities. Thank you, sister.
Thank you so much.
Conversations with Consequences, now on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Ashley McGuire, and I'm so excited to have one of my dearest friends of the show on today, Lady Sarah Elliott. She is an old friend of mine and also someone that has been working on issues that we care so much about. Her title is, she is the director of the UK-US Special Relationship Unit for the Prosperity Institute. But she's somebody who is an American who's based in the UK, who regularly appears on different programs, writing about, speaking about, and advocating for policies encouraging economic prosperity, individual freedom, and cultural goods. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ashley. It's great to be on.
Yes, it is so great. And we were joking with our producer, our wonderful producer, that we were worried we might have a little too much fun, but we have so many interesting topics to cover. I mean, the UK has been so much in the news lately. Some things being a little bit depressing, but certainly the thing that everybody's still talking about is King Charles' historic visit to the Vatican with Pope Leo and the public prayer service that they had in the Sistine Chapel, the first time that a British monarch has prayed publicly with the Pope in basically since the Reformation. And, those centuries saw much horrible bloodshed and persecution. So, Sarah, what was your reaction to that prayer service and to the other ecumenical gestures, the granting of a throne that they may be one? What was your reaction to that visit? And what was the reaction even among Brits, and especially Catholic Brits, but really everyone.
Yeah, I thought it was an amazing moment, actually. Huge historic significance that I'm not really sure the British public fully grasped at the time, because as you probably have read and know, the British public's very secular. But from a Christian historical perspective, it was a massive moment. First off, that was the first time that a British monarch had prayed with a pope, or probably since 855. From the year 855, when, oh, let me get my kings right. Well, King Alfred the Great, who was to become King Alfred the Great, was there with his father at that time. And of course, King Alfred is known as the first king to unify England and unify it based on biblical teaching and principles. For that reason alone, it was huge. I thought of Our Lady of Walsingham, who is a great Marian apparition that happened in the Middle Ages. It was one of the most popular pilgrimages sites in Europe, in medieval Europe. She is also recognized by Anglicans as well, and there's a shrine at Our Lady of Walsingham to both, well, to the Our Lady of Walsingham, but by Catholics and Anglicans. And she's all about Christian unity and bringing Christianity's back to one, worshiping body. And I just thought, mate, the prayers of Our Lady of Walsingham are working. The work of Pope Benedict coming in 2010, setting up a personal ordinariate to be able to absorb Anglican parishes at one time so that, again, we can all be under the true teaching of the church. I just thought all of this is coming together. I think I felt like there was something bigger going on. There's prayers are being answered, and time will just tell what happens with the Anglican Church here, but it is not in a very strong position in the UK. You have more practicing Catholics than you have Anglicans. The Anglican attendance, Sunday attendance rate has dropped three quarters since the 1960s, and 20% of Anglican parishioners have not returned after COVID. So, it is a time where actually the Catholic Church is gaining prominence when the traditional Church of England, the state religion, is waning.
Well, and it's so interesting because this visit came just on the heels of what many people call the desecration of Canterbury Cathedral when we woke up and saw that the pillars were covered with graffiti. I mean, thankfully, we learned that they were stickers and it was not a permanent installation. But this was not an act of something by some street thugs. This was something that the cathedral allowed. And I thought it was so interesting in an article by Damian Thompson for First Things. He talked about this. He said the Canterbury Graffiti Project, he called it a quote, farcical attempt to seem relevant, but it ironically underlines the church's loss of relevance. Did you see it that way?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I obviously have my perspective. I come from it from more of a conservative viewpoint, but I see all of these as the final last grasps of the identity political movement, and it just illustrates how not all cultures are equal, not all art is equal. Not all, it just is like, how can you compare that graffiti to the beauty around it in Canterbury Cathedral that's over 1,000 years old? You and all the amazing bravery and martyrdom that has taken place there. It just pales in comparison, and quite frankly, looks very silly and stupid. And I do feel like these are like last grasp attempts, but it's illustrative that, still wokeism and political identity is very much alive and well within the Anglican Church and very much practiced in the UK, even though I feel like there's a little bit more wind at the back of those of us who want to push against it. I feel like people who, and I think a lot of it does have to do coming from the United States and the Trump election, and his repulsion of it. It's giving people confidence to say, no, actually, this doesn't work. We don't like it. It's disrespectful, and it's just not true. So, I think it's despicable. I'm glad it's just a sticker. I hope it peels off easily.
Well, and it
But
seems
I don't think it's lasting.
right. And it seems sort of emblematic of a classic misunderstanding, which is that in order to gain followers, religion needs to accommodate the cultural winds of the day. And in fact, as you mentioned, The opposite is happening. It's happening in the United States, and it seems like it's happening in the UK. There's talk of what people are calling a quiet Catholic revival. And I was stunned by the numbers that I read that among young Catholics in the UK, their numbers are up 22%, whereas those who self-identify as Anglican is down 10%. And am I correct that Catholics now, young Catholics now outnumber Anglicans in the UK? And if so, why? Why do you, what's happening?
Yeah, I think it was a study that came up by the Bible Society, and do double check this, but I think you're absolutely correct. That did come out, and I just think for a couple of reasons, it's very attractive to young men who are in their 20s and teens, and I think that's because they've been told that they are bad and that they're toxic, and the Catholic Church, upholds masculinity, says it can be, it is a positive for society and it is necessary in society. And so I think they're gravitating to that. I also think it's tradition. It's complete opposite of what they're being offered in society, which is hedonism and debauchery and stuff that leads to a lot of pain and suffering. And people want to do something different. And I do think that there are people, examples in society, and people look to that and go, actually, I want to be more like them. They go to church on Sunday, or they believe in God, or maybe even looking back at their grandparents and saying, you know, I really respected my grandmother, my grandfather, and they really believe this. I want to understand more of what they believed and went to church every Sunday. I mean, we're getting to a point in the UK where young people have never even walked into a church before. They weren't dragged by their parents. They weren't even baptized. Their parents weren't even have very few, if any, memories of going to church. So we're a couple of generations removed now of being actual weekly churchgoers. And so what does that do? That actually brings curiosity back to people. They don't have a negative association. They're actually kind of confused by it. So they're seeking that. And there's beauty in the church, and there's holiness, and there's reverence, and there's a hierarchy, all these things which, society says we don't need anymore.
Well, and it certainly rings true for the both of us. We're both converts, and I certainly, that was very much my experience. And I think, I can speak for both of us when I say too that another thing that drew us to the Catholic Church was its unflinching stance for the dignity of all humans, from the unborn until those who are facing natural death, and for the most vulnerable, disenfranchised members of society, and that consistent ethic of life. And that is needed so much now more than ever, both in the United States, but really the United States is looking at what's happening in the United Kingdom with this death march of assisted suicide. And it was really disheartening to see this summer the Medical Aid in Dying Bill passed the House of Commons for the first time, and then went to the House of Lords. And really, people were watching with great, I think, fascination and a little glimmer of hope to see that in the House of Lords, there was a lot of impassioned speeches given, and it seemed very much sided among those who were against this bill, which would legalize assisted physician-assisted suicide in the UK. What do you think is the were Brits watching this, and what do you sense is the pulse on that issue right now? Are people afraid of it? Because I think here in the United States, people are afraid of it and what it means for them and for vulnerable people, for their loved ones.
I think it's quite shocking to those who aren't following the culture war very closely to see that this country, who's really was one of the leaders in the Western world, in the world for defending human rights to begin with, and also ended slavery, was the for and lost many sailors, like over 1,000 sailors' lives patrolling the oceans trying to prevent the slave trade. To see this happening in the UK. And not only did they pass assisted suicide that same week, they also decriminalized abortion that same week. So it was like the culture of death just completely reigned in June of this summer, June 2025. I think people, what I really found somewhat encouraging by it is that it didn't pass by very much. And also that there were many people on both sides of the aisle. It did not fall down party lines because neither political party has taken a stance on this. And they also have given the politicians a free conscience vote on it. So they're not going to be whipped either way on how to vote on it. So you could vote with your conscience. And so we saw very prominent labor leaders, side with Jacob Rees-Mogg on the Tories on this issue, including the NHS health minister, the head of the NHS, which is the National Health Service. Wes Streeting was against it. A lot of criticism was on, safeguards, and that's what really the Lords came in on and started to nitpick. But at the end of the day, Parliament is sovereign in the United Kingdom. There are not checks and balances like there are in the United States. When you have a majority, even if it is of one, the leader of your party is prime minister, and you can pass whatever you want. And the Lords can delay it. They might suggest some tweaks to the bill, but it will pass. So it's a very different system that way. And I think it's really woken up the country to what happened in the general election in 2024. It's all about reorganizing for the next election now. But in the meantime, this is what we have. Now, the rollout will be long. It hasn't started yet, although some claim that they see this already in the NHS anyway, the assisted dying. But so we may not even see it come to full fruition, but legally, it will be legal.
Well, and you have interesting perspective. Your husband is in the House of Lords and courageously spoke out against it. But it is, I'm reading the book Lord of the World right now, and this was Pope Francis's favorite book. He actually asked people to read this book. So I finally took him up on the request when he passed. And it's chilling because it was written almost over 100 years ago. And in it, there is a ministry of euthanasia. So here we are, in this brave new world. But you mentioned abortion, which is another issue that you and I care about, and something the church has been so steadfast in its opposition to. And some more recent statistics came out that are hard to take. I mean, people were focused on numbers coming out in the United States, but then you flagged the fact. Another study that found that half of pregnancies in the UK end in abortion. And the thing that was, abortion is always tragic, but this comes in tandem with our declining birth rates in both countries. And it seems as though people are getting pregnant less and aborting more of those pregnancies. And so do you see, but at the same time, there was a huge turnout for the March for Life in the UK. Do you see any hope on that front?
Well, I do, and I do have hope, because but things have to always get dark and really grim, unfortunately, for humankind before they can turn things around, I find. One area I have hope in is actually in immigration. So immigration is a huge topic here in the UK, as it is in the US, but the United Kingdom is much smaller than the US. We have an issue with these boats coming over, bringing migrants from Calais, which is on the shores of France, and coming in and then have the government houses them and pays for them and gives them phone and food. And so that is very controversial here. And the numbers keep going up and up with immigration each year. It seems like it's uncontrollable. But because of immigration, we have a lot more Eastern Europeans. We have many more Catholics in the country. We just have a lot more social conservatives. We have many more people from the Caribbean and from Africa. And even the Muslim population here, they're very socially conservative, and they're not going to put up with this. They're anti-abortion, they're anti-euthanasia. We have five independent Muslim MPs. They will probably most likely form an Islamic party at some point, but they're on side with all of this. So the coalition for defeating the evil that this is will look different than the United States, but is there. You can do it. And like I said, it was a very close vote on euthanasia. Abortion, we have to work a little more. We have to work harder on that one. But, people are also not very educated on abortion and what it entails and all the medical emergencies, especially with the at-home abortion pills. But that gives some hope on the immigration front that we do have a lot of social conservatives now in the UK. But also the church, that people are seeking truth and they're speaking out more. And I think we're finding younger people are speaking out more against abortion. And they're, that kind of emboldens the older generation to speak out more. So I think there are glimmers of hope. I have to say the Right to Life UK over here is fantastic. They're one of the best well-run campaign groups in the country, and they're on it, and they get their messaging right, and they're everywhere. So that's a wonderful campaign group to follow and support. So there, we have some wonderful leaders, and as it is with every generation, you have a couple of people who are just real standouts, and they bring a lot of people to the cause. So I see that happening here in the UK, and we also have GB News, which is a relatively new news network that is beating the BBC and Sky News in ratings. And they allow conservatives to talk and be open, and they're all about free speech. And that is also helping with the messaging.
Well, we'll have to have you back on another time to talk about the free speech issue because we're just
Oh,
about
yeah.
out of time, but that is another topic that, people in the United States are really watching and wondering, is this really true? It seems so Orwellian. We had Maddie Cairns on to talk about the issue of people being arrested outside of abortion clinics
Oh,
for
yeah.
abortion. And so there's just so many important issues that we as Americans need to be educated on to understand, because our fates really are linked. I mean, that's seems to be the consistent theme of the last, several centuries, certainly
Yes.
the last 100 years, is that the fates of our two countries are linked when it comes to the fight to preserve Western civilization and Christianity. So there's
Yeah.
work to be done, but there's also things to be optimistic about. And so we thank you for coming on today and giving us the perspective of an American who's living in the United Kingdom, working at the forefront of these issues. So thank you, Lady Sarah Elliott, for coming on our show today.
Well, thank you for having me, and I hope it's helpful.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences, where I am joined by our TCA resident chaplain, Monsignor Roger Landry, who is also the director of the Pontifical Mission Societies here in the United States. Welcome, Monsignor. And this is a great back-to-back Holy Day feast celebration weekend of All Saints and All Souls.
We have a lot to look forward to this weekend. First is All Saints, which is the day in which most of us hope to be remembered after Jesus comes for us. Few of us, Betsy, are going to be canonized and have our own feast day on the calendar. But we're all made for heaven if we strive to enter into Jesus, who is the narrow gate. And so we hope, if we've lived a truly successful life, and we hope all our deceased grandparents and great-grandparents and other loved ones that we have, that November 1st is their feast. And so it's a day in which we come and we thank the Lord for the gift of salvation, which makes heaven possible. We thank him for the extraordinary witness of all the canonized saints that we know about, who are such role models for us. But it's also a day in which we celebrate all those hidden saints next door, those saints in our own family who have lived and died in a way that was ultimately pleasing to God. We don't know whether they're in heaven or not yet, because they haven't been canonized, but we have great hopes based on the way that they live, the sacraments they received, even at the end, you name it, that they are totally with God. And so we celebrate them. And then, according to what they sing down in New Orleans, when the saints come marching in, we're praying that we will be in that number. And so it's a day in which we stoke our own desire for holiness. This November 1st is going to be a little different because, as we mentioned a few weeks ago, Pope Leo on that day is going to declare Saint John Henry Newman a doctor of the church. And now, last week, it was mentioned that he will, with Saint Thomas Aquinas, be named the co-patron of Catholic education. And so I would anticipate that there are going to be a lot of priests who will be highlighting the summons that you and I and everybody have to become saints in life. That's what the Second Vatican Council called the universal call to holiness. But going to illustrate that through the life and the words of St. John Henry Newman, the 38th Doctor of the Church. And so that's going to be a particularly special day. And then it's going to lead into Sunday, which about every 7 years on average, we have the privilege to be able to celebrate November 2nd, the commemoration of the faithful departed, popularly called All Souls Day, on a Sunday. When it's celebrated the other 6 days of the week, really only daily mass goers are generally able to experience the fruits of that. But when it falls on a Sunday, all Catholics are able to experience it. And so why is All Souls Day super important? Because the most important thing we need to do for those who have loved, we've loved and who have loved us, who have died, is to pray for them. There is one of the most common heresies today that thinks that no matter who dies, they basically all go to a better place. We don't know that for sure. Jesus told us, don't judge lest you be judged. And that clearly means don't condemn somebody to hell, because we can never know what their motivations are. But it also means don't canonize somebody without the church. Don't automatically say that basically everybody except Adolf Hitler and Osama bin Laden or anybody we don't like goes to heaven. We don't know that. And so we come together and we pray for our faithful departed, that if they need the prayers, our prayers and our sacrifices made for them in the communion of saints will actually help them in the purification that's needed in purgatory in order to make heaven. We remember in the second book of Maccabees when Judas Maccabeus was going out with his soldiers and they won this huge battle, but he had said, remember, don't take anything for yourself because everything's meant to be dedicated to God because he's the one who brought us to victory. A person was struck on the battlefield, and when they were preparing to bury him, they realized he had a lot of stolen property. And so Judas Maccabeus and his fellow soldiers had sacrifices made for him in the temple, saying that it would have been a worthless thing unless prayers for the dead matter. And they do matter. We see that throughout Catholic history in the tombs, in the Vatican Scavi, in the catacombs. People were always praying for their deceased loved ones who have died. And so that's what All Souls Day is. And it's one of the 2 days during the year. I'll ask you a trivia question on the fly. It's one of the 2 days in the year in which a priest is able and encouraged to celebrate three masses because of the importance we give for praying the dead. Do you have any idea the other day during the Catholic liturgical calendar in which the priest is encouraged and given permission to celebrate three masses?
Well, I want to say Christmas and Easter, but I have a feeling that this is a trick question, Monsignor.
Oh, trust yourself. Your first answer was right. Okay. So Christmas is the other day. So you're just showing off your brilliance. For all our listeners on Conversation with Consequences, please know that I hadn't fettered the answer ahead of time. Betsy really, really scored on that one. But Christmas and All Souls are the 2 days that we're able to celebrate three masses it's also the day in which a lot of parishioners will see their priests dressed in black vestments as we mourn our loved ones and we show the death that takes place in us. It's one of the reasons why priests dress in black, because we're advertising in our clothing first Christ's death and then our death to ourselves in order for Christ to rise from the dead. And so lots of priests will wear black vestments. They could also wear purple. They could wear white by exception in the United States. But that's a day in which we, as one whole community, pray for our faithful departed. We mention them in every Eucharistic prayer in the Mass. We're praying for the deceased because we think that they might need it. And this is a day in which, at the beginning of the month of November, dedicated to the four last things, death, judgment, heaven, and hell, that we ponder our death and so that it can be a truly happy death, a death lived in communion with the Lord whom we love, a death in which we're eager to go with him to the place he's prepared. And we pray for our faithful departed that they were likewise ready to take on Jesus's gloriously scarred hand as he led them to that place in the Father's mansion.
Well, this is a beautiful reflection again on this glorious weekend. We're within the 2 days, we basically pray for every single person that's gone before us.
And
thank
we
you
pray
for
that
joining.
we, likewise, are going to become holy, so that, God willing, and by his mercy, we will be united with them again.
Thank you so much for joining us, Monsignor.
God bless you, Betsy.